Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey people, how's it going? Thanks for joining me for episode 39 of A Small Voice. This week I chat with Daniel Castro Garcia about his book project, Foreigner, Migration into Europe 2015-2016. But before I introduce Daniel properly, let's rip through a bit of photo biz. The 2016 Visura Photojournalism Grant has been won by Suvit Datta. He won for his long-term project, Vanishing Girls of West Bengal, which explores the socio-economic context perpetuating child trafficking. Many congratulations to Suvit. I think he might be the occasional listener. I hope he is. And if you're listening, well done, mate. Now open for entries, the 2017 Zeiss Photography Award, Seeing Beyond. That is, I guess, under the auspices of the World Photography Organization. And winning photographer will be awarded $12,000 worth of Zeiss lenses and $3,000 worth of travel expenses to complete a dream photography project. So quite a nice little prize. That details at worldphoto.org. Many congratulations to Justina Milnikovic. I hope I've pronounced that right. Sorry if I haven't. She's won the W. Eugene Smith Fund 2016 grant for humanistic photography. So a big prize. She gets $30,000 to complete a project, which is, in her case, a diverging frontier, Russia and its neighbours. So she's been working on that for a very long time, and will continue to do so now, having been awarded that prize. Call for entries of the afternoon, an exhibition which is going to take place at the Print Space. If you're a London-based photographer, go to oftheafternoon.com to find details of that. The deadline is very soon, November the 1st, but that might be of interest. And the Nikon Walkley Awards, which is a prestigious annual photographic award for excellence in Australian photojournalism, have had the winners announced. Andrew Quilty, I think, won the photo of the year, but you can find details of that online. The Guardian did a thing. Have a look on there. Use Google. You know how to do it. Of course, it's Paris Photo coming up in November. There's also a thing called Photo Fever, which is, I guess, a sort of runs alongside it, an art fair. Looks interesting. That's at photofeverartfair.com. My guest this week is Daniel Castro Garcia. He studied Spanish and Latin American literature at University College London, and after graduating, went on to work in the UK film, commercial and music video industry, where he still works as a freelance first assistant director. That's how he pays the bills. But for the past 5 years, his real passion has been for photography. Having started out as a street photographer working on personal projects, his work now focuses on social documentary and portraiture. In May 2015, Daniel started a photography project about the current European refugee crisis, which has seen the greatest number of people forcibly displaced from their homes since the Second World War. And that project, in collaboration with his creative partner, designer Thomas Saxby, has been self-published as a book entitled Foreigner, Migration into Europe 2015-2016. It was shortlisted for the Mac First Book Award, and also more recently for the Paris Photo Aperture Foundation First Book Award. Great chat with Daniel, very smart guy, very thoughtful photographer. I get quite passionate at one point. I didn't really expect that to happen, but we were talking about some of the tough questions that we need to ask ourselves as photographers. And, you know, I think sometimes it's necessary to do that. Here's Daniel. We're going to talk primarily about Foreigner, Migration into Europe 2015-2016, which is your first book. But I thought, let's just do the kind of backstory first, I think. You grew up in Oxford.
Yeah, I was born in Oxford, went to school there.
And both your parents are Spanish?
Yeah, both my parents are from Galicia, which is in northwest Spain, right from the coast. And they came to the UK in the late 60s. And I was born here, but I go back every summer and Christmas to see my family and stuff.
Oh, great. Well, so who's still there? You've got grandparents still there?
Grandparents, cousins, yeah. Loads of awesome. Friends. Yeah.
What made your parents come here then?
I think, to be honest, just sort of looking for an opportunity to work. You know, kind of dictatorship Spain. Galicia was a really sort of marginalised part of Spain and, you know, very agricultural and fishing and just very poor, you know. No, like my parents didn't have an education, and
right.
My dad used to be a chef on sort of fishing vessels and like merchant ships.
Right.
And I think they just sort of came to a decision to come to the UK. My dad had a cousin that had come a few years before and said, you know, there's work here in hotels and kitchens. So, you know, my mum was a cleaner, my dad was a chef. So
right. Yeah. So yeah. That made sense.
Yeah.
Pursuing the working opportunities.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what kind of kid were you then?
Well, I'm an only child, so
right.
I think I was probably a selfish brat, to be honest
really?
With you. Yeah, I think so. Looking back, but I was just like growing up, I only cared about football, to be honest. I'm just football through and through, so every single day was all about playing football. I was really sporty, and to be honest, like academia was not something that came my way that easily. I think I got to a stage where, you know, I understood that I had to study to get the grades to go to a good university and stuff. So kind of, you know, I did work hard for that kind of thing, but it wasn't, you know, I was never that interested in much at school, to be honest.
Yeah. But you just
didn't have like that passion for a subject, maybe languages, but.
Mm. What did you do at university?
I did Spanish and Latin American literature.
Right. So you had a bit of an advantage. I presume you learned Spanish.
Yeah.
At home, yeah. Speaking to your parents.
Bilingual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what were the advantages of being an only child then? Because I'm asking for my own selfish reasons. Because my kid is going to be an only child, obviously. Not obviously, but he's going to be an only child. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of wish I had siblings, to be honest.
Right.
I do wish that, because I just think it shares the burden of your parents' expectations a little bit. You
right.
know, and I wish I just had a brother or a sister that could either bring more joy or, you know, less grief than I bring
yeah.
to them, you know.
Take some of the attention away from you.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good
But,
point.
You know, it's cool. I mean, it is what it is. I've got loads of tight yeah. friends that are like brothers, so.
But and in what way do you think it has given you advantages?
I mean, you know, I think my parents have given me unbelievable support, mm. you know, and they've helped me through things that I needed help with that perhaps if I had, you know, siblings, they might not have been able to do, you know. They
yeah.
I went to really good schools and they very much sort of lived their life to kind of give me a life that they didn't have, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
they
no,
wanted
exactly
me to have an education and to really prosper in that sense. So yeah, I don't know. It's a hard question. I do think about the only child thing quite a lot, but I never seem to draw any conclusions mm. from it, to be honest.
Mm.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, good.
yeah.
At some point you got interested in, well, either photography or moving images. I'm not sure whether you're primarily a video guy. How do you feel about it?
I mean, I'd say, like, my brain is both. Mm. Like when I was at uni, I did like a film module. So we kind of analysed a few sort of Latin American and Spanish films, and particularly films that were kind of coming out during the dictatorship, and we were analysing them. And I think that really kind of like planted a seed in my mind about, you know, the reasons for films being made. So I wasn't just interested in the entertainment of it. It was about that authorship of a director and the message they were trying to get across. And in my final year of uni, I had a friend that was working at a film production company, and I was just really passionate about film. All I did was watch films, really.
Mm.
And he said they had internships at where he worked, so I went straight into an internship at this company, and I interned at three or four other movie companies for a year, you know, unpaid after uni, sleeping on my mates' floors and stuff. And eventually I got offered a job at one of the places I was working. It was, you know, not like low paid stuff, but You know, it was enough to survive. And from there, I kind of realized I had more of a passion for working on set. And, you know, I always had this idea that I wanted to direct and stuff. And yeah, I just sort of spent a couple of years running on music videos and commercials, and then worked on movies, some Hollywood ones, some lower British independent films. And I think the long form, you know, aspect of films, I think, was sort of getting to me a bit, the kind of 5 a.m. till 10 o'clock at night, kind of 6 days a week, wasn't really working for me. So I then went freelance and worked on commercials for 3 years. But then...
And what were you doing? Were you directing or were you assisting?
No, so I was a runner, so part of the assistant director team. And I think, like, in commercials, I kind of came to a point where it was like, my God, there's only so much I can handle watching this biscuit get broken 10 times and, you know, not feel satisfied with my job, you know. And so I kind of decided to sort of stop running and try and climb the assistant directing ladder. So doing, you know, lower paid jobs in higher positions, and, you know, it's kind of paid off. So now I'm a first assistant director on set on music videos and commercials, and you know, it's I enjoy it because it's, you know, it's freelance, so it's not every single day, and it gives me a lot of flexibility to concentrate on photography, which I had been doing since, you know, 10 years ago anyway, but it's just become a way more important part of my life.
Right. So in a way, the video thing is the kind of, is your kind of bread and butter. That's what pays the bills.
Yeah.
And the photography is more of a kind of personal passion in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, with video, you know, I still have the hope to be directing more. And you know, I do shoot things, but again, they're kind of more personal projects. But yeah, the thing is that with photography, I like the independence of it. I like that you don't need anyone else for it, really. It's just you, your camera, you go, you do it. Whereas with filming, you know, depending on what it is you want to shoot.
Yeah, it's more of a team effort.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've got that string to your bow. And I mean, a lot of people, it's funny because you've kind of almost done it the other way around. You did the video and then you kind of got into photography. And a lot of people are thinking at least about the prospect of moving into video, just because, you know, in some ways that's where the prospect of earning some money is, well, it seems to be the case. When did the photography become more of your interest then? What do you remember the actual kind of
there was kind of a stage like 5 years ago where I wouldn't leave the house without a camera, and I was, you know, mainly doing sort of street photography and portraiture. If I kind of felt that I really wanted to interact with someone that I felt kind of, you know, had a sort of look or something that I was interested in. And yeah, I ended up like sort of having this huge body of work, like mainly digital images. And a friend of mine, Diego Ulrich, who's a graphic designer and bookmaker, you know, we sort of discussed the idea of maybe trying to do some sort of handmade copies of, you know, the work and give it some sort of reason. So we ended up making 30 copies of kind of a selection of my work that had a narrative to it. And after that, I kind of, you know, I've been living in London for 12 years and kind of hit a bit of a brick wall in a way, just kind of felt a bit saturated, and decided to go to Amsterdam for 6 weeks and do a project out there. And so that was kind of the first time I really went out specifically to shoot a project that was really simple, clean portraiture, and like combining it with the sort of the cityscape. But again, you know, like a super internal kind of project and strife and, you know, me just kind of looking for an avenue to express myself that I couldn't do in words, or, you know. So yeah, I'd say over the last 5 years, and coupled with photography books, you know, and falling in love with certain photographers.
Who?
I mean, I think like the real kind of early guys that I loved were Daido Moriyama, and a Spanish photographer called Alberto Garcia Alex. He's just, you know, he's kind of like a like 70s, 80s kind of period of Spanish photography, like very personal sort of punk movement photography. And
yeah, I don't know him, but
yeah, you know, I've got a book here I can show you. And yeah, I think they like their work kind of just, I think it's like when you find an author you love, you know, and you end up reading three or four of their books. I had that same issue, like sort of situation with certain photographers, and kind of subsequently really kind of developed a passion for books too, you know, photography books and what they kind of represent. You know, you then meander off and you're looking at sort of Nan Golding, you know, Ballad of Sexual Dependency, or Robert Frank, you know, now I guess kind of quite easy references to find, but when you're coming across them for the first time, you know, they did really hit me. And I think they really sort of showed me what I think photography is all about in many ways, you know. So yeah,
so really this project that has now turned into your first book, it was kind of the first major project you've ever done, really. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely on this scale. You know, I think it's sort of important to mention that I've done this in collaboration with Tom Saxby, who is my sort of partner. We kind of run a sort of studio together. It's like photography, video and graphic design studio. Tom comes from a graphic design background. And I think, you know, I've always been interested in migration and sort of different communities and different nationalities live, like even just living in London, you know, I was lived in Shepherd's Bush for 6 years, and it was a very sort of Somalian, Eritrean, sort of North African community. And it was just, I felt really amazed by the kind of culture around there and just all around London, full stop, really. But I think this project was really born as a result of feeling completely unrepresented by the media and the way the media was treating the subject of, firstly, the sort of refugee migrant crisis through Africa from Libya into Italy. And then obviously as time passed, the, you know, the kind of Syrian refugee crisis, which, you know, also has Iraqi, Afghan, you know, many other nationalities came through in that sort of flow of people over the last couple of years. And yeah, I think it, you know, having sort of taken photographs on such a personal way prior to this, I really felt like I wanted to do a piece of work whereby the photography had more of a story to it and more of a reason. You know, it wasn't so personal. It was about, I mean, essentially, you know, my feeling for this whole project is that I kind of wanted to use photography as an empowering tool and a dignifying tool.
So what kind of spurred you to initially go and do it then? Was there a particular moment?
There was definitely like one incident in April 2015, where over the course of a week, two boats capsized in the Mediterranean and over 1,000 people lost their lives. And, you know, it just really hit me. You know, it really hit me what that means, you know, and what that, I kind of couldn't stop imagining what that situation would feel like. And again, you know, the media reaction to that in the UK was, I think, kind of quite shocking. You know, there was headlines which were sort of saying use gunships to send them back, or you know, like the kind of conservative, like, let them drown policy, whereby you know, they kind of had this theory that, you know, Mare Nostrum was not only a rescue mission but a pull factor for people to do these journeys. And you know, I've got to be honest with you, that's, you know, it's ludicrous. I can't understand, you know, being a sort of 30-year-old, I think quite well-rounded, what I considered, you know, a European individual, to have a government of a country like, you know, the UK sort of have this rhetoric and, you know, giving, you know, UKIP having a platform for this kind of fear mongering to do with migration, I think was just too much. So, you know, we decided like that week we bought, Tom and I bought tickets to go to Lampedusa. And so the first trip I did was to Lampedusa and then Catania.
In Sicily.
In Sicily, yeah. Yeah.
I think, you know, you've mentioned that, as you say, it was a kind of reaction to some of the, to the very kind of typical, fairly cliched kind of front page newspaper pictures that you're seeing, especially in the tabloid press and the right wing press, and the way in which those, like you say, those stories are being spun. But also, you know, there's a lot of, there was a lot of very serious photojournalists, probably half the serious photojournalists on the flipping planet, come to think of it, doing the same story. So, you know, what did you think that you could maybe bring that was different? Did you not, were you not concerned that you were just going to be another guy doing that story?
I was concerned about that, but at the same time, I wasn't really, because, you know, like you say, there's been some truly phenomenal photojournalistic work done on this subject and stuff that's inspired me. But I think the one thing that I felt was missing was a real sense of intimacy in the images. You know, there's incredible shots of, you know, people climbing through wire fences and people getting gassed and, you know, like beach landings that are very dramatic. And I get that, you know, I get the value of the work and I get the kind of hard beauty of the image making, but I didn't want that. You know, I wanted to go out and stand in front of a person and communicate with them and ask permission for images.
Yeah.
Like, I think that was the most important thing. Like, there are some more traditional photojournalistic images in the book, but generally it's about portraiture, you know, and it's about a relationship and it's about that individual story that I just feel was so lacking in the media.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. As you say, what you have included some of those more kind of familiar kind of images. What you've done is you've used those in black and white as a kind of, I presume, as a kind of deliberate, what would be the word? A kind of deliberate...
like distinction, I think. Yeah. Like, and I think also, you know, the sort of part of the book you're referring to is in Lesbos. And like the first trip to Lampedusa was kind of the backbone and the pillar of the project, in the sense that when we arrived there, there were no migrants or refugees on the island. So it meant we had to, you know, interact with the place in a very different way to what we expected to, and have this kind of slower approach to the image making. And in Lesbos, you know, there was a strong media presence, you know, 50, 60, 70 photographers and, you know, news cameras there. And I found myself kind of wanting to compete in a way, you know, kind of getting involved. And I don't know, I personally sort of felt I lost the perspective of the project a little bit there. And
because you were drawn into the sort of gravitational pull of that approach, and everyone's kind of in it together, and it's a big fucking bun fight, basically.
Basically. And like I said, you know, I understand why, but, you know,
I'm not sure I do understand why anymore. That's the question that I'm sort of struggling with these days. I really, you know, wondering, you know, if there's really any point anymore.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's definitely a valid way to think about it. I think, like, for me, what it...
Because if it doesn't change anything, sorry to interrupt,
yeah, sure,
Danny, but if it, you know, if it really doesn't change anything, which it doesn't seem to, and people continue to drown and die and you know, if you look at Syria and what's been going on there for an unbelievable amount of time, you know, and what difference does some fucking pictures make anymore? And people are getting killed, you know, to take those pictures. Some very, very fine journalists and photographers have died as a result of working in those kind of environments. And I'm just really wondering whether there's any fucking point anymore.
I mean, I think, you know, personally, you know, without meaning to sort of sound like some kind of, you know, I think if you are concerned about the world and there's something you feel is wrong, it's kind of your duty in a way to go out and do something about it. And, you know, I kind of feel that photography can serve a purpose of sharing information. Mm. That's what I think it is. You know, it's sharing stories and sharing information. And someone like Don McCullen, I think, makes that kind of point sometimes, that he sort of feels that even his work has changed nothing. And maybe it hasn't. You know, there was the whole massive public reaction to the Alan Kurdi images of him washed up on the Turkish beach. And I think more than anything, I think people need to sort of be open and accepting of their own hypocrisy and fickleness. Mm. You know, I think the whole hashtag refugees welcome movement, you know, is then ground to a halt by sort of compassion fatigue. And I think these are way more deep rooted issues to do with our kind of developed Western society, you know, than it is about the people that are A, photographing it, and B, the people that are in these situations. You know, it's how we react to it.
Yeah. And like, you know, this is in no way a criticism of the kind of people who do that work. I mean, I have an enormous amount of respect for those people. We all have friends who do that kind of stuff. And, you know, they're compassionate and smart and incredibly committed people. And they really care about, you know, those stories that they're working on. But if, you know, if a refugee boat is landing on the beach and there's 50 guys there going click, 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 what the fuck is the reason for them all being there, apart from the fact that, you know, they've been commissioned to do it, and, you know, all the newspapers, you know, each want their own images or whatever, but then it all goes into the pot kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's almost like, let's just send a guy. Yeah. He can be the guy.
Yeah.
And then we'll all look at those pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. And I definitely had that feeling in Lesbos. You know, there was a moment where I was sort of interacting with a woman and her child and wanted to, you know, I was taking their photo. She'd kind of granted me the permission. And, you know, all of a sudden, I'm sort of surrounded by 15 other people that are taking that photo on big Canon 5Ds. And it's, you know, it's loud. You know, there was a violence to it. And, yeah, I definitely think there is some ethical boundaries that get crossed in this kind of work. That
because you're in the service of, you know, in a way there's, you just, I guess, you become to some extent desensitized to what's happening, and, you know, you're there to do a job, and you're not there to, you know, worry too much about what the impact of it is. I mean, I suppose we're talking about a certain type of news photography here, rather than photojournalism, which covers a whole multitude of sins, as we know.
Yeah.
But when you went to Lampedusa, I was thinking that, well, what's interesting is that you, in a way, you turned a disadvantage into an advantage, because you got there and everyone's gone. And, you know, a lot of people go, that's a bit of a disaster. Did you feel?
Yeah, I mean, like,
what was your reaction?
I'm super emotional, you know, and super nervous a lot of the time. And Tom is the opposite. He is, like, you know, super chilled about everything. And, you know, the first day we were there, it was like, right, so where, you know, we're not professional journalists. You know, this is the first time that we'd kind of gone out looking for this, you know, to interact with a news story in a way. And I mean, I was just dismayed. I was like, oh no, like, I want this to be about people. I want to photograph people. But as we went around the island and, you know, we discovered the boat graveyard and we're looking at these fishing vessels that are smashed and have shoes in and trousers in and, you know, tins of tuna that are kind of unopened. And, you know, that was a marker. That was like, there was a spirit there, you know, there was something powerful just looking at that. And then just the island itself, you know, this very, very kind of arid landscape that, you know, when you look at the news, was going through these cycles of receiving hundreds and, you know, thousands of people that weren't native to there, and how much of a shock it was for the people there. And, you know, their fishing industry suffered so much because, you know, they'd have these mass sort of tragedies really close to their coastline and nobody would want to go out and fish, understandably, you know. And then, you know, just going around the island and actually going to the cemetery and looking at, you know, graves with numbers on. You know, that was it. That's what people were reduced to, you know, numbers. And I think, yeah, you know, the that was so important because it was, you know, it was sobering. It wasn't the hysteria of, whoa, there's loads of people, I've got to ping and go over here and go to the next person.
Yeah, you know? So in a way it kind of set the agenda in a way, but it was almost accidental. It was, you know, necessity being the mother of invention and all that. You had to react to the situation you found yourself in. You weren't planning on doing those kind of images, I presume.
I think in a way, well, maybe not directly those. I think like, I mean, it just like another sort of inspiration would be Tim Hetherington. And one of his projects where he documented the graffiti around Liberia, I believe it was. You know, that also made me think about taking your time to really look around, you know, look around and look for clues and look for evidence of things. So, you know, there's that part of kind of going into Lampedusa and fine, there aren't people here, so I got to look for clues, you know, and we found clues. But then also, you know, there's landscape work in that chapter that I think also was just trying to serve a slightly more poetic purpose, you know, like let's look at the geography of where this situation is taking place.
Yeah. So what happened after that?
So, you know, we had originally booked it was only supposed to be a 10-day trip to Lampedusa, and after 5 days we'd kind of visited and revisited all of these spots that we'd found, and we kind of thought, like, we can't waste this opportunity. What do we do? And we sort of researched Sicily and saw that most rescue ships were now going to Sicily. So we flew to Catania and sort of had a base there and found out about a huge reception centre called Gara di Mineo, which is in a town called Mineo, about an hour away from Catania. And this place had something like, I mean, excuse me for not remembering the figures, I think like 2,000 people living there. It was like a former US military base that had been donated to the EU a few years ago and was now being used as a reception centre. So we drove there and met people, you know, because people were allowed to walk out of the camp and you're just driving through sort of orange orchards to get there. And we would just start seeing these groups of people sort of lying under trees, and it's like, whoa, something, you know, this is interesting. And eventually got there, parked up, and started speaking to this guy called Musa from Gambia, who became a really close friend over the last year and a half. And there sort of started the relationships aspect of the work and getting to know people and finding out their stories.
And that was really your intention. I mean, did you have a plan or a strategy or a sort of idea of what you were doing before you left, or were you just going to see kind of how it went?
Not really, because I think I was so influenced by the kinds of images I was seeing. I very consciously wanted to go out of my way to create images that were the opposite of that. So the kind of big wide crowd stuff I wasn't interested in. I wanted to find one person and frame it and interact and, you know, give people an opportunity to present themselves to. You know, I think that was a really important aspect of the portraiture for me.
And what kind of reactions were you getting? Were people generally quite sort of, were they skeptical or were they distrusting of your motives, or did you find it, you know, the opposite?
I mean, generally, I found the opposite. Like a lot of the time, you know, my camera was in my bag. You know, it was not like I'm ready to photograph now. You know, it was more about I'm ready to talk. I'm ready to hear you out. You know, and I would just explain to people that I was, you know, doing a photography project about this situation, and I'm not associated to the media. I don't have, you know, I'm not working for any newspapers. Their images won't be going on the news or anything. And people generally were kind of happy to sort of collaborate, really.
Yeah, they realised that maybe your agenda was slightly different.
Yeah.
You were talking about how Tom, who, as you've said, is your kind of creative partner. In fact, he's not a photographer, he's a graphic designer. He designed the book, which we'll get onto. But I was going to ask, in what ways did his presence kind of influence the way that the project went? You gave a good example of how he's got a different kind of personality to you. So are there any other examples of that, you know?
Tom came for the Lampedusa and part of that Catania trip, and then in November, December, when I did a road trip from London all around Europe, he came for a week of that trip. So a lot of it, I Tom wasn't with me for the image taking, but when he was, you know, we developed ideas together, you know, and that's what me and him do. I think a good example of that is an image of a boy called Ali in Catania, where he has sort of sand coming out of his hands.
Yeah.
And he's also the last image in the book, where he appears in a red robe. And, you know, Tom and I just bounce off each other. You know, I think also where generally my emotions are always kind of really high and his are a lot lower, we kind of meet in the middle. And you know, Tom is always asking me why. You know, why this, why that?
Right. And which is a brilliant kind of question to ask, right?
Absolutely, you know, because sometimes
when you're in it, you don't stop to ask yourself that question. Yeah. It's good to have someone there to provide that service, as it were.
And I think it's, you know, it's great to take images just because you want to take images, and I'm all for image making 100%, but thinking about the reason why, I think, filters out a lot of that kind of potential for just doing things for the sake of doing things, you know, and that's almost like a really important first barrier to have. So, you know, it's.
Well, in a way, you're kind of starting the editing process right at the point at which you're taking the pictures. You know, you're making some editorial decisions at the time of shooting.
Yeah.
And I guess there are different approaches. Some people just maybe, you know, want to keep things incredibly wide to start with, incredibly kind of open. And then maybe when it comes to editing, things start to emerge. Yeah. But, so the book, was it always in your mind, or did it only occur to you? Because this was, like you say, really your first big project.
Yeah.
Some people do 10 big projects before they even come to the book idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that, you know, me and Tom collaborate, and he's, you know, in my eyes, just an unbelievable sort of at what he does. You know, we really early on had the idea that we wanted to make some kind of paper copy out of this, whether it was a free newspaper or, you know, I don't know really what, but I think there was always that potential and that hope that we could make an alternative to a newspaper, basically, and make an alternate type of information for people to consume. And so I think, like, it was after that, the Lampedusa Sicily trip, where, you know, we started, you know, we made a PDF that we would send out to websites and see if it could get featured or the work could get featured, which, you know, heralded very little results. You know, I think we had, like, It's Nice That did a piece about it, you know, which was great. But, you know, I guess maybe it wasn't a big enough body of work at that stage to spike too much interest. But, you know, we realized, like, I was addicted by that point, and everything for me became, how do I save up enough money, or how do I get the money to do a trip around, you know, all over Europe and catch up with the guys in Sicily. You know, I think for me, it was the revisiting was a fundamental aspect of the book, you know, when you're seeing the same person either in the same place 6 months later or in a different part of Europe, however many weeks or months later. I think, like, the book, though, kind of came by good fortune. Bruno Bailey, who's the editor of Vice magazine in the UK, nominated me to enter the first book award, which is organized by MacBooks. So Tom and I kind of took that as an opportunity to make a dummy and enter it into this competition.
Okay, so he'd just seen the work online, presumably.
Yeah, I know Bruno. I've known him for years, and
he thought that you should just do, like you say, do the dummy, turn it into a book.
Yeah,
it almost seems too easy. You know, just do a book. Then Michael Mack has a big like conniption about it, and tells you know Alex Soth and Martin Parr to get behind it.
Yeah.
Then you know, just then you do a Kickstarter campaign. Of course, you get funded. It's just you made it look too easy, Danny.
I've got to be honest. From that sort of second trip to all over Europe, and then in January going back to Calais a few times, to then kind of realise, right, well, we do have an opportunity to make a book here, because if we didn't do it now, this could, you know, knowing me, could still be the thing that I'm kind of editing 2.5 years down the road. Let's get on with it. Let's get on with this and
give yourself a deadline in a way.
Let's do it. So, you know, we had the deadline of the dummy book.
And also the fact that you got Thomas right there to do because if you had to find a designer and all that, it would have been a nightmare.
It just wouldn't have happened. Yeah. You know, it just wouldn't have happened.
So you really just took advantage of that situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and we should stress that you didn't win the Mack First Book Award.
No, no.
I'm not sure why, because Michael Mack clearly was championing the book. So I don't know why he didn't. Presumably, I don't know if he makes the decision or whether there's some kind of panel who makes the decision.
Yeah, there's a panel. There's a panel of four people.
Right. So it wasn't entirely in his hands.
No.
But it sounds like he was enthusiastic about it.
We found out he sort of emailed us to say that we'd made the shortlist, unfortunately hadn't won, and then there was a PS, can you come into the office for a meeting? So Tom and I went, and we just thought it might be a bit of feedback about the project, and he sort of said that, you know, he felt that this was an incredible body of work, an incredible effort, and, you know, a great, great book. And he really wanted to provide us with an infrastructure to self-publish it.
Mm. That must have felt pretty good.
It was amazing. It was amazing. I think, like, you know, 10 years after sort of leaving uni and working and freelance, you know, you don't really get any feedback off of anyone for anything. And, you know, I think also, like, I think sort of kind of prior to this project, I've never really been a fan of social media. Like, I don't have Facebook, and Instagram was, you know, something that I used, but it was, you know, it wasn't like I'm getting any likes or anything. And to all of a sudden have someone of this kind of, I guess, gravitas.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, we should, just in case, because obviously not everyone listening knows, we should mention Michael Mack is the boss of Mack Books, which is one of the kind of top photo book publishing outfits we have. He used to work for Steidl for many years. Steidl also being one of the main ones.
Yeah.
So you I guess you were encouraged by his kind of
absolutely, and you know, to receive that kind of enthusiasm and support and encouragement was incredible, because from that meeting, you know, which we thought was going to be like a 20-minute thing, it was an hour and a half, you know, where 45 minutes was discussing with Michael what we should do, and we concluded on a Kickstarter. And, you know, he told us about ways that he would go about sharing the work and, you know, getting it on their newsletter and stuff.
Right. So at no point did he actually offer to publish it.
No.
And I think, what was his thinking behind that? That he couldn't turn it around quick enough that he needed.
No, I think that it's a very different book to the type of book that Mack produce. You know, it's very kind of, I guess, kind of fine art work. Mm. You know, and
which I guess is maybe that's why it didn't. I mean, the one that won was probably more up their street.
I think it was. But he believed in it, you know, he believed in it, and he kind of wanted to see it out. And I think especially with the whole Brexit thing coming up, like, he just felt that it was an important book to get out before that. So he gave us a deadline. He said, if you can do this in sort of 6 weeks, launch Kickstarter, get it made, we'll launch the book for you at Photo London, which was in May. So we left that office kind of like, what the hell do we do? You know, and we did a Kickstarter page with a, I mean, a hilarious video where we were just both so knackered and just wasted, really, from what had been now like 6 or 7 months of like 24/7 kind of work, to be honest. But, you know, we managed to raise the money. It was incredible. We did it really quickly. And
yeah. And how did you, I mean, you set a goal of 18 grand, which is quite a decent sized chunk of change. How did you come to that figure?
So basically, you know, that meeting with Mac, after the sort of first half of the meeting with Michael, we sat with his in-house designer, Lewis Chaplin, who helped us develop a spec sheet for the what would be the actual book, so the types of paper that we should use based on the dummy. You know, we wanted to stay true to the dummy. And you know, they then gave us, you know, a list of 5 print companies all around Europe, and you know, this is the number of pages, this is what we want to do. We wanted to re-edit it. I also did my final trip after that meeting to Idomeni because I wanted to bring the book up, you know, kind of up to date.
Right. So I helped cover some of that.
No, I paid for that myself. Okay. Yeah,
because 18 grand for 1,000 copies seems like almost twice what some people seem to manage to do it for.
I don't know. I mean, we kind of, you know, sent our specs to all different companies, and yeah, it was kind of the figure that that they give you. I mean, I think the printing of the book cost 15 grand, but then you have, you know, you need to have packaging and all of that stuff and postage, which, I mean, all of this was completely new to us. You know, we did not realize like that once the book was made, and because we've self-published it, you know, Mac launched it and sold it via their website for the first sort of month and a half, 2 months after its release. But then it was up to us. You know, we found a distributor and we've been contacting Book Tom's been, you know, amazing at contacting bookshops, and I've had to focus more on trying to get press for the book and stuff. So it's been a full-time job.
Yeah, but you seem to have managed to have gotten quite an amazing amount of press. Some of it is quite, you know, mainstream media, and I'm wondering what, you know, is there some kind of secret to that? Because
I don't know, to be honest.
Well, again, you're making it all look simple again, Danny.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely not been simple. I mean, you know, certain organizations contacted us, which was amazing because a lot of them were kind of, you know, British Journal of Photography is a magazine that I've been sort of devouring for years, you know, and to all of a sudden kind of be emailing them about a potential feature and stuff was like, what? Wow. But then other than that, like loads of it has just been us, you know. I've been emailing this magazine, that magazine, you know. So I think combined between, you know, people reaching out to us about the project, we've also had to reach out too.
Yeah, you've been proactive about it, which obviously you have to do. Yeah, so how closely did the final book resemble that dummy, just out of interest?
Relatively close. But, you know, it's a cut down, like in the first dummy, there was a lot, you know, not a lot more, but there were a considerable, you know, number of images more in the dummy than there are now. And I think that's only, you know, I think that was a completely right thing to do, you know, streamline it and make it solid rather than, you know, fluffy. And
yeah, you should always, you know, reduce, yeah, and kind of,
editing is an essential part of that. And then, you know, some of the design features of the book are pretty much the same, like the spine's a little bit different, and you know, the writing in the book got tightened up.
You included quite a lot of text. A lot of other books, you know, kind of deliberately avoid text, but I guess for some it's more appropriate than others. But what was your thinking behind the text that you've included?
Well, I think you know, because we sort of wanted to you know, the book is like a passport, and all the fonts are like a passport. We thought that the captions for the images should just really be kind of very basic, almost like identity kind of work. So it's the location and the date, that's it. Or if there's a person, then it's their name and the location and the date. And at the beginning of each chapter, I think, you know, with a book like this, you need to give a bit of a context for the images. You know, you need to explain slightly what certain stories are about so that the viewer, so to speak, can identify more with the work. I think if it didn't have writing, then it would, you know, it would just be a series of portraits and sort of photojournalistic work without any context.
Yeah, you definitely need that. So you developed some quite close relationships. Can you tell me about a couple of people who you've got to know quite well?
Yeah, I mean...
the guy with the sand running through his hand, for instance. I think his name's Ali, is that
Ali, right? Yeah. Nickname's Gucci. Okay. Yeah.
What's his story?
So he's 26 years old. He left Senegal when he was 19. His mum, dad, and three siblings kind of left there with the hope of getting to Europe and, you know, having a brighter future. And it took him 2.5 years to get to Libya. He was working in Mali and different countries on his way, earning money for the next bit of the journey. And he made it to Italy, where he's been living for 3.5 years, still doesn't have a work permit. He used to work in the market selling fake trainers, which he can't do anymore because, you know, he's been told, like, if he gets caught doing that again, then his sort of asylum claim is brought right down to the bottom of the pile. And so, yeah, like, the relationship with him, you know, just started. I just went up to him. I was just like, hey, this is what I'm doing. And we ended up exchanging numbers and meeting up the next day and taking the first portrait I did of him looking straight into the camera with big dreadlocks.
Yeah.
And we stayed in touch pretty much every single day since then. And
that kind of brings up an interesting point in a way, which is that what you have is a combination of kind of economic migrants and also refugees from kind of, you know, places like Syria, which are obviously in the midst of extreme
violence.
So there is a whole spectrum of different types of people who are kind of there for different reasons,
yeah,
or have left their countries for different reasons,
yeah.
And you've not worried about making any kind of distinction in a way.
I mean, I write about it a little bit in the intro and explain the difference between an economic migrant and a refugee. But I think for me, you know, sometimes the reasons for economic migration are just as valid, you know, like extreme poverty that, you know, I don't think anyone I know could come close to comprehending. Is just as valid a reason for wanting to leave and seek a better life and a better opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, I fully understand the kind of political issues around that and the legality of certain types of movement. However, you know, the experiences of many of the people that reach Europe are horrendous, whether it's crossing the Sahara Desert on pickup trucks and if people fall off, they're just left there to die. In Libya, you know, they get put in jails for no reason, really, and no food or water and are beaten. And then, you know, what they suffer at the hands of traffickers and their experiences in the Mediterranean. I think it's happening, you know, it's happening for a multitude of reasons. So I think even like climate change is in the next, you know, that's going to result in the next sort of mass movement of people as well, you know. And I think for me, like on a sort of political spectrum, there's this kind of arrogance about who makes someone more worthy to be someone, you know, and it goes to the kind of simple argument of like, well, you know, some of us are just lucky because we were born somewhere. And on a personal level, that just doesn't cut with me, you know. Like there are Gucci speaks 5 languages, you know, he's fully able to work and be anything he wants to be. And I think, you know, I think there is a kind of latent pleasure in the political system and the bureaucratic system holding people back, you know, so that we can marginalize and have a distinction in our society. And to be honest, just to kind of reference one guy that is just doing unbelievable work and research on refugee integration is an Oxford University professor called Alexander Betts. If anybody just looks him up and looks at his TED Talks, you know, he does amazing projects in Africa and different parts of the world where they stimulate kind of an economy for refugees and displaced people to get communities thriving and be fully sort of valuable members of a society, you know. And I just think that should be happening a lot more easily.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess the timing of this, of our chat here, is quite apposite, because I think they're clear. The jungle, so-called, the Calais kind of refugee places, are currently, I think, being cleared as we speak, more or less.
Yeah, as of tomorrow, I think.
Today or tomorrow. And the first influx of kids, I think, has just been announced, you know, from on the grounds of the, I think it's called the Dubs Amendment. Lord Dubs brought in, and there's gonna the 50 kids have just come in. I guess I'm thinking about, again, back to kind of what we were talking about, what's the point and why, and what's the impact. I mean, actually, you shared images over social media, didn't you? Because I'm thinking, you know, the thing about the book is, although it's a lovely thing, the audience that you're reaching is relatively tiny. Mm. You've printed 1,000 of them. So would it be more useful to share the images online, to put them on a Twitter feed or an Instagram feed?
I think, like, you know, this is kind of going into a direction which I've been thinking a lot about. And it also taps into sort of my personal concerns about images and the lifespan of images. Like, you know, social media, whether it's Facebook or Instagram, you know, the way you consume an image is so brief. Like, it can be a straight up swipe past it, or a few seconds, or, you know, maybe a minute. Like, I mean, how many people actually look at a Facebook or an Instagram image for more than a minute? I doubt anyone. You know,
a few seconds.
Newspapers, that's a day, maybe two if you're picking up yesterday's paper. Mm. Magazines, it's a month. And for me, I think for Tom and I, we wanted to create something that also had a bit more of a historical value to it.
Right.
You know, and even if the audience is smaller, like, hopefully the book can survive and it serves as a good body of evidence of what a situation was like in a period of time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And it's education too, you know. I think, like, looking, you know, anyone that might find the book, I mean, you know, I don't know what real educative value it has, but you never know, it can end up in certain libraries and someone can look at it and really make a considered opinion about this particular book and this particular moment, you know.
Yeah, it's a good point, because it's kind of a trade-off between, you know, the number of people who are going to see it and the longevity of the images.
Yeah.
And really what you're talking about is that, okay, there's a 1,000 copies right now, but you know, if they're going to still be around in 10 years time, then you've got to include the number of people who are going to see it over time, although there's no impact it can have on the story and at the moment.
And, you know, also, again, like, on for me and Tom, you know, the fact that it's a book has opened doors to us. You know, we've met Channel 4 News and Médecins Sans Frontières about potential future projects, and they're, you know, they're very much projects that we want to take on with, like, seriousness. You know, there's like, the book itself is released under John Radcliffe Studio. You know, we're not on an ego trip here. We're trying to represent people. And that's what I feel like. That's why I think reaching out to the press and getting the book in as many, you know, well-respected bookshops as possible is important, because we're representing people, you know, and it's their story that we're trying to get out there. And if in doing that it changes one person's opinion, or makes them do something, or makes them think differently, or talk about it openly, then I think, you know, we've achieved something.
Yeah, totally. And as you say, you know, in a way, the press that you get as a result of doing the book is more valuable than the book itself in terms of getting the story out there. But you're not going to get that press if you haven't done the book. The book is what draws people's attention, because it's...
Yeah, and I think, you know, it also shows a commitment from us to the story. You know, it's not about, like, taking an assignment that's just a brief thing, you know. It's we've really taken it on wholeheartedly, you know, and I think people that have interacted with the book kind of see that, and yeah, I think that's, you know, that's a positive outcome, you know.
Yeah, totally. So how many have you sold?
Well, we're down to our last sort of 70 copies, and we're going to keep those.
Wow, that's great.
And so you've, everything else is either in bookshops or has been sold. Yeah,
amazing.
We have some with our distributor still, but yeah, like there's not much more we can do now to get it out there, other than, you know, maybe the remaining copies we try to get into, you know, this notion of the right hands, you know. But I think it more or less is finding that kind of route on its own at the moment, which is great.
And also, I should mention that some of the price has gone to charity. You've been able to give a certain percentage away.
Yeah. So basically, you know, originally, I mean, even within the book and at the back of the book and in certain chapters, we comment about certain charities that have done certain, you know, amazing work that we really feel is important to support. And then, you know, every month we kind of see what we've managed to make, and we give, you know, a percentage of that back. To be honest, like, I think it's a difficult one for me to talk about, because over the last few months we've just been supporting one person. And, you know, someone out there might think, oh, that's, you know, ethically a bit weird or something, which, you know, I actually don't really care what someone else thinks about that, because if we were to, you know, giving to charity is essential and incredible and, you know, really impressive that people do that. But I can see there's this one person that I can help directly, and it changes their life. And, you know, we're not making any money out of this. Like, what we make is for the book and for him, you know, and he helped us make it. So,
yeah, you're just kind of giving it back,
you know.
I don't think anyone's going to judge you for making that call. That, you know, you, instead of spreading the money around, you've kind of focused it on one.
Yeah,
person.
I mean, I think maybe it was a bit like, you know, where we said we would give it to charity, you know, where we have done some of that, we've also then just given it to one person, and maybe that line of charity, you know, I don't consider it charity now. Like, it's earned, you know, it's earned. And I think subsequently, you know, that's also more dignifying, you know. They did this with us, you know. Yeah. So yeah.
So the inevitable question is what's going to happen next? You seem to have quite a lot of ambitious plans between you and Tom for John Radcliffe Studio.
Yeah, I mean, I think
where do you see it going?
Like, we kind of really want to open it up. Like, we've kind of got a sort of new member now, which is a young photojournalist called Gus Palmer, who is a relationship that I've made during the course of this project. And, you know, he's pretty much like a family member now. Incredible photographer. Like, he's only 21 years old, and he has been all over, you know, Africa and the Middle East, and spent time in Iraq. So
really,
yeah, like, one project we're going to do is probably make a publication for him.
Bloody hell, he's 21.
Yeah,
he's a little bit precocious, isn't he? I hate him.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the same time, it's, you know, yeah. Oh, he's a great lad. But, you know, I think it's important to support work. You know, I support work. I'm not a hater. Like, you know, I love people doing, I want to help, you know. I believe, and I love photography too. So
yeah, because it seems like because, you know, kind of collaboration has been a key to all of your experiences, even from doing the movie thing, you know, and realizing that's very much a team effort. And then you're working with Thomas, so it's just a very natural thing for you to just, it's not, like you say, you're not kind of a massive egotist.
No.
You want to, you know, find the value in working with other people. I think a lot of people are starting to think along those lines.
Yeah, I think it's the way to go. And I enjoy it. And Yeah, you know, going forward, you know, between me, Tom and Gus, or, you know, we've got ideas of what to do next. Like, we'd love to do a project in the Mediterranean.
And are you going to draw on your video experience, your filmmaking experience?
Yeah, I think that's I want to pay more attention to that now. I'm not 100% sure in what capacity yet. I think, like, what I'd like to do next year, as of sort of February, is maybe move to Catania for a little bit,
yeah,
and sort of immerse myself in the community there, and kind of maybe run a bit of a workshop where, you know, collaboratively we can write a script together and film it and get, you know, some strong sort of moving image work done. But yeah.
Yeah, so you're going to be a multimedia guy. It seems to me that, you know, that you're of that, well, you've got the right background in,
yeah,
and you can exploit those different approaches.
Yeah.
Yeah, are you kind of excited about the future? Because you seem to be kind of, in a way, you've, like I say, you've made it look easy. It might have given you a false sense of of optimism, but then there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's hard. I think, you know, from a kind of career perspective, I would maybe like to earn a little bit more of a living from photography, just because I enjoy doing it, you know. And it
as opposed to the video stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I enjoy the video stuff, but, you know, it's not... I don't know, it's not, I don't want to be an assistant director my whole life, you know.
Right. I mean, how would you, so if you look at your income pie chart, what would the ideal one look like? How would it break down in comparison to how it is now, which I guess is like 100% of it is the video work you're doing, the kind of, you know, freelancing as a assistant director?
You know, I would love it if I could, you know, if I was sort of had to work for a month in, you know, video stuff, and then could have, you know, a 3-week trip somewhere, you know, that at least my costs were covered, you
right
know,
well, that's quite well, okay, yeah, that's pretty modest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really interested in making loads of money, but
you could, you know, you could be a jobbing kind of editorial guy, you could be doing stuff for magazines and you know, those kind of,
yeah,
publications.
I would love to be doing that.
They don't pay particularly brilliantly, but
yeah, I mean, I'd love to be doing that, but you know, it's not happened yet. I mean, I hope that might happen at some stage, but equally, you know, like where you say, I do have a source of income. I'm happy to respect that, and also happy to kind of carry on working on our projects, you know, that are personal to us. Well, I say personal, it's just sort of self-initiated.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy to do that, you know, as well.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering what you've learned about this process, or through doing this process, you might, any kind of top tips you might be able to pass on to people, either in terms of the Kickstarter campaign and how to make that work, because you raised a lot of money, and some people don't manage to raise half that. And of course, a lot of it's, you know, to do with the fact that the work's good. Let's not kind of, you know, beat about the bush there. But yeah, either about the Kickstarter or even the book making process itself. What your kind of lessons learned?
I learned so much. I mean, God. I mean, first thing I would definitely recommend to everyone is just keep your files really well organized, because there was one night where I was told that we needed to provide CMYK files, which I would transfer the image to CMYK, and they're like grey. And I was like, what? And I'd spent the whole night then editing a CMYK file to look normal. That was completely the wrong thing to do. So
right. Okay.
Stay in control of your files, man.
Basic fucking stuff that no one tells you, like that.
Basic shit. Stay in charge and top of your files. But no, I mean, I think for stuff like Kickstarter, right, it's just about getting it out there, you know, and like the only thing I've kind of taken from this is just work hard, you know, work hard, and you kind of, I think, get your just rewards eventually, you know. But then also, you know, it's not it's like depends how you want to go about your career, I guess. But I sort of see it as a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
You know, so
well,
one wants to sort of fly by.
Yeah.
Career, you know, or
no, yeah. I think you've kind of just hit upon practically the two most important fucking life lessons that there are, really. Work hard, and it's a marathon, not a sprint. Yeah. Cliches, maybe, but for a very good reason. Those two things, and you know, speaking as someone who learnt those lessons way too fucking late, I don't think you can improve on those as kind of, you know, top tips.
Yeah, just like you just can't take things personally, you know. If like I used to sort of feel like, oh God, I think I'm taking good photos, no one's seeing them, this isn't, you know, my career's not changing, but it doesn't matter. Like, it's just a learning curve, you know. You can't be fussed about what other people are doing, you know. You've got to concentrate on what you're doing, you know. I think that's the most important thing that I've learned. It's just don't worry, you know, stop worrying about other people and just enjoy your own thing, you know. And that's what we're trying to do, and concentrating, you know, really concentrating, and that, again, that whole why, you know, why are we doing it, and just trying to check in with those sort of standards and values that we want to set for the work.
Thanks, Danny. Really nice to chat.
Cheers.